Now, here is Bill Resnick.
Hi, thanks, Lori, and congratulations to Joe Clement, our ace engineer and often interviewer and great musician. John Pfeffer, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me on the show.
John Pfeffer is a foreign policy specialist affiliated with the Institute for Policy Studies in the heart of darkness, Washington, D.C. It's a progressive think tank, an action tank in Washington. He edits the online journal Foreign Policy and Focus for the Institute. He writes a great deal, many op-ed-style articles that address the great issues facing the world. He's done several on the Iran issue today. His recent books include Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, and a novel, Splinterlands of a Global Dystopia in the year 2050, warning us about some of the terrible developments in today's world. But while he has in Gramsci's well-known saying, a pessimism of the intellect, he also has an optimism of the will and the intellect. Things really could change for the better. John Pfeffer, tell us about Iran, why Trump withdrew this country from the arms deal, and tell us about the current struggle. Why is the U.S. so obsessed with Iran?
Well, those are tough questions. As your listeners probably know, the Trump administration came in with a mission to unravel all of the accomplishments of the previous administration, the Barack Obama administration. But top of the list was the Iran nuclear agreement, the agreement that the United States and Iran signed that would put very strong limits on Iran's nuclear program and basically prevent it from ever having nuclear weapons. But Trump basically said this wasn't good enough. He wanted to address other issues in the U.S.-Iran relationship. He withdrew the United States from that agreement last year. And more recently, unfortunately, things have heated up even more. And one could even say that we are on the precipice of a war with Iran. The United States has strengthened economic sanctions against the country. John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, made a warning that if Iran were to attack the United States or any of the U.S. allies in the region, then that would be a reason for the United States to attack Iran. And then most recently, there were reported assaults on four ships in the Strait of Hormuz. These were Saudi and United Arab Emirates ships. And the United States has pointed the finger at Iran as being behind these attacks. And Iran has denied it, but nevertheless, this has brought us to the current moment where we are bracing for a potential attack by the United States against Iran.
Yeah, we've sent U.S. B-52 bombers within an hour of all of Iran. We've put some warships, aircraft carriers in the Straits of Hormuz, armed with the latest deadly weapons. We've threatened over the years, actually, that we will operate in any way we feel necessary. It seems to me they're really trying to frighten the Iranians into something, but it's not clear that they're really just setting up things to invade in one way or another.
That's correct. The Trump administration has been of two voices on this issue. There has been the kind of fire and fury rhetoric that Trump has occasionally engaged in, which he says that, you know, if Iran were to challenge the United States, we would destroy it forever. Regime change rhetoric from both Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Bolton himself. On the other hand, occasionally we get some glimmer that Donald Trump himself would like to basically pull a North Korea. In other words, completely change his rhetoric, as he did with North Korea, and instead of lambasting Iran, reaching out a hand for negotiations. And he has said, you know, here's my phone number. I want to get together with you guys. I want to sit down. I want to negotiate a better deal. So even at this time of great crisis, where as the United States has been brandishing its stick in a variety of different ways, Trump himself has basically put out what might be considered an olive branch or maybe an olive twig, if you will.
It seems to me that's sort of maybe a sort of good cop, bad cop, or whatever they're doing. But is there a basis for negotiation? My sense is that our Iran policy is basically driven by both the Israelis and the Saudis, who see Iran as their great enemy, because, in fact, they really are challenging, at least providing some challenge or support to the people who are challenging Israeli expansionism and Saudi Arabian, whatever you call that, kleptocratic and merciless state. And it's also challenging the Saudis by assisting other Shiite states in the area or cooperating states to, in fact, rebel against sort of the Sunni domination. It's like Northern Ireland is my sense, but maybe that's wrong. The Catholic-Protestant split, well, there's a Shiite-Sunni split, but it's also a class split with the Catholics and the Shiites as the second group. So is there really a possibility of a negotiation when at least those two countries and many other sort of factors weigh against it?
Well, you're right. It is very difficult to imagine that it will be easy to bridge this confessional divide in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia is predominantly Sunni, although it does have a Shiite minority. Iran is predominantly Shiite, although it does have a Sunni minority. I do think, however, that it's not just a religious divide. Iran is a strong economy. It has a very strong middle class. It has, obviously, natural resources, oil, natural gas. It could very well be the economic powerhouse in the region if it wasn't under rather strong sanctions. Saudi Arabia, I think, is not only worried about Iran's reach, you know, to its Shiite brethren, for instance, in Yemen, or even in Saudi Arabia itself. Saudi Arabia is worried about Iran's ultimate economic power in the region. And I think that ultimately is what it's trying to prevent. Israel is concerned, of course, about Iran reaching across the confessional divide and supporting not just Hezbollah, which is Shiite, but also Hamas, which is predominantly Sunni. So Israel is concerned about that. Israel's concerned about, well, it says it's concerned about a nuclear weapons program, but let's be clear, even according to U.S. analysts, Iran hasn't had a nuclear weapons program since 2003 and probably not even for much before that either. So the prospect of Iran actually having a nuclear weapons program is relatively thin at this moment, and yet Israel has hyped that threat considerably, in part because it helps Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, secure his political base. So there are a number of different factors that play into this that have little to do with, say, U.S.-Iranian relations per se, dating back to, say, the hostage crisis of 79, or the nuclear agreement on the positive side that the Obama administration negotiated.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to John Pfeffer, a foreign policy specialist who has written on Iran and the struggles in the Middle East. We've been talking about why the U.S. is sort of involved and what they're doing and the possibilities of some sort of negotiated settlement. John Pfeffer suggested that, in fact, the U.S. does not have basic disagreements with Iran, but some of our friendly states that we support, Israel and Saudi Arabia, really are, in fact, in some ways threatened by Iran. And, in fact, my sense is, John, when you look at the state of Iran, it may be the only big oil-exporting state. Well, maybe Venezuela is actually another state under sanctions and being attacked by Trump. But Iran does have democratic elections. They may be more democratic than the ones we have in the U.S. if you look at all of the factors and variables and how policy is made. Although I wouldn't go too far with that argument, but there's still quasi-democratic and moving in that direction. It seems to me that Iran actually does deserve some support when you compare them to the actions of their adversaries.
Well, you're right. I mean, you know, Saudi Arabia is far from a democracy, about as far from a democracy as you can get. And you don't have to engage in any sophisticated arguments about whether Iran is democratic or not democratic or how or where it is on the spectrum of democracy. The most important thing is that the folks in power right now are reformists, and they have supported a nuclear agreement with the United States. They've supported a more peaceful engagement with the United States and with Iran's neighbors. The alternative in Iran is clear. There are the theocrats, the conservatives, the hardliners. They, unfortunately, are strengthened by current U.S. policy, because the hardliners in Iran say, look, you know, we told you not to trust the United States. We told you it was a mistake to have this nuclear agreement. And now look, look at where we are. We signed this nuclear agreement, and our economy is tanking because of these heightened economic sanctions from the Trump administration. So it's extraordinarily important to, for us here in the United States, to understand that supporting these reformers, Hassan Rouhani, the president, Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, is vital for sustaining peace in the region. And ultimately, you know, this extends beyond the Middle East, because we're talking about Iran's relationship with Europe, Iran's relationship with North Africa, et cetera. This is extraordinarily important to basically strengthen our relationship with this faction within Iran.
John Pfeffer, let's go to back to the United States a little bit and the making of foreign policy and action. My sense is that what comes out of the Trump gang is this weird good cop, bad cop, but no actual negotiating position that could possibly work. But what's sort of limiting now Trump from doing something truly crazy and bizarre is the U.S. military, it seems to me, is very wary of getting into another war. After all, they've spent trillions and lots of lives in a hugely humiliating war in Iraq and Afghanistan. The neocons, in fact, are completely humiliated because Iraq and Iran are now, in many ways, allies. What we did in the Middle East was strengthen Iran, to the neocons' consternation. And I think they're doubling down. They just want to attack this country who has made them so, this whole group of foreign policy, quote, experts in Washington. You probably see them operating every day. Anyway, but the U.S. military, I think, does not want to get into, they're willing to move their B-52 bombers and put their warships around, I mean, when he orders it. But when he ordered people to leave Afghanistan, they wanted to, and Syria, they wanted to maintain forces, and they did. So Iran, they basically disobeyed his orders, but he doesn't remember things very well. What about, or that's how he operates. What about in Iran, is the U.S. military, am I right that they're really hesitant to go on the attack?
Well, generally speaking, the Pentagon is a risk-averse institution. It doesn't want to take any risks that are unsupported by the likelihood of victory. So when John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, asked the Pentagon to draw up plans for an attack on Iran last year, the military, frankly, was aghast. I mean, it did it because, you know, it was being asked to do so. But up until recently, we had Jim Mattis, who, even though previously he'd actually been let go by the Obama administration because of his eagerness to be more aggressive with Iran, in this particular context, he became a much more conservative voice with respect to Iran. But he's gone now. So I'm afraid that what the Trump administration has done is cleared away some of the conservative obstacles to launching an attack. Mattis gone, Bolton himself really narrowing the conversation on foreign policy to just one or two people so that he has preponderant influence on Trump.
He really is a Rasputin, isn't he, in some ways?
Yes. So I'm rather pessimistic about the military serving as the ultimate break on a war on Iran.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick talking to John Pfeffer about Iran. What could stop a war on Iran? What can we do in this country? And what might the Europeans do about the U.S. with their sanctions and their control of international financing, sanctioning countries and actually forcing the entire world to cooperate with its foreign policy? It seems to me humiliating for European elites, but of course they're getting rich off of that same policy. How can we stop a war on Iran and talk about things sensibly?
So quickly, there are three things. One is, of course, popular mobilization. If it's clear to the administration that, Trump will lose votes and lose votes by large numbers in the next election, if he were to go ahead with a war, then he would think twice. The second is, as you point out, the external actors, European Union coming up with another mechanism by which it can maintain trade with Iran, but also the actions of Russia, China, other big powers saying to the United States, no way, we're not going to stand by and allow this to happen. And then finally, Trump himself making the decision to stand up to both his Secretary of State and his National Security Advisor, which again is not unprecedented since that is exactly what he has done on North Korea.
Yeah, Trump is looking at the next election. He looks at the polls and he looks at his popularity, right? I mean, he's sort of a TV celebrity. And when the polls go down, and for him, you have to, flattery is everything. So it is possible, in fact, to mount that kind of opposition to that and in favor of a decent negotiated settlement in the Middle East. John, give us about 30 seconds of inspiration on that, and then we have to sign off.
Sure. It, of course, is a difficult position to be in, to put one's hope on foreign policy issues on Donald Trump himself, given his record. But we have to remember that this is a man who campaigned against the Iraq war, and saying that it was a bad idea. He has largely said that he doesn't think that we should commit U.S. troops to conflicts around the world. He is concerned about the amount of money that's being spent on the U.S. military, even as he increases military spending. But this is something that we can hope for, at least for the next 18 months while he is in office.
Yeah, and a big movement here really could have an impact. Thanks so much for talking to us, John Pfeffer of the Institute for Policy Studies. And you can look up Foreign Policy in Focus and see a lot of his writing. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate it.